Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm John Boland, President and CEO of KQED San Francisco, and your chair for tonight's International Relations member-led forum program, generously sponsored by Ernst & Young. Our guest tonight is James C. Hormel, advocate, philanthropist, and former United States Ambassador to Luxembourg. A champion of social justice and equality, Ambassador Hormel is a noted LGBT activist, a founder of the Human Rights Campaign, and has been honored with a number of awards for both his leadership and philanthropy. In 1999, Hormel became the first openly gay person to serve as a United States ambassador when he was appointed by President Bill Clinton. Prior to his appointment, Mr. Hormel has been an alternate representative of the U.S. delegation to the 1996 United Nations General Assembly, and a member of the U.S. delegation to the 51st U.N. Human Rights Commission. Over the years, Ambassador Hormel has served on a number of different boards, including the Board of Directors of the American Foundation for AIDS Research, KQED, the Board of Trustees of the San Francisco Foundation, and the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club of California. In 2011, he published Fit to Serve, Reflections on a Secret Life, Private Struggle, and Public Battle to become the first openly gay U.S. ambassador, a memoir of his life in public service and struggle for equality. Ambassador Hormel shares a name with a famous American brand as he is the grandson of George A. Hormel, founder of Hormel Foods. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago School of Law, where he also served as a dean. Hormel is a father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, and is a leading citizen of San Francisco, where he resides with his partner, Michael Nguyen. Tonight, Ambassador Hormel will be in conversation with Dr. Sandra Hernandez, President and CEO of the California Healthcare Foundation. Dr. Hernandez is former CEO of the San Francisco Foundation, a position she held for 16 years, during which time Ambassador Hormel served on the foundation's Board of Trustees. An assistant clinical professor at the University of California San Francisco School of Medicine, Dr. Hernandez also maintains a clinical practice at San Francisco General Hospital in the AIDS Clinic. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador James Hormel and Dr. Sandra Hernandez.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Did everybody hear me? Well, good evening. Thank you, John, for that nice introduction. Jim, Ambassador Hormel.
It's a privilege to be with you, Sandra.
Quite an honor to be able to have this conversation with you tonight. So thank you for agreeing to do that and for launching this month's programming for LGBT at the Commonwealth Club.
Looking forward to it.
I thought that we would maybe travel a little bit through history, since your life, beginning in your early professional years and beyond, has really chronicled many of the both low points and incredible points associated with LGBT movement. And so I thought we would start maybe when you were in Chicago and when you first really began to struggle with identifying with who you were and coming to grips with it. And so what I thought I would do as we started that, if you don't mind, is to read a very short excerpt from Fit to Serve, your memoir, because I thought it was incredibly poignant as you wrote it. And it is certainly something that many people who come out initially come to grips with. And it says this, and I quote, "As near as I could see, the revelation of my homosexuality could only be destructive. The end of my perfect family, the loss of love from a woman I truly cared for, and the complete and total blockade of all pathways to professional success. I would not be a congressman or a prominent businessman or any other sort of pillar of the community. I might even lose the job I had." This was a period of time when sodomy laws were still in place, and yes. You were a practicing lawyer and living and working in at the Chicago School of Law. I wonder if you'd share a little bit, Jim, about how that sense of what would not happen by coming out over the course of all of your advocacy was a turning point for you as you began to sort of contemplate what might be possible as a gay man.
Well, as you indicated, the atmosphere was very challenging, to put it mildly. I wore this tie for this occasion. It's pigs flying. So I had to regard all of the things that you read in that statement in the context of a society where the limitations were such that people didn't talk about sex of any kind ever. And when the police would choose to raid a bar or a bathhouse, the names of the people who were in attendance were taken and delivered to the local newspapers, which gleefully published them. So that the pressures, the social pressures, were exacerbated by the publications and the spreading of the word. I once looked at the Tribune and saw a piece about a bar and looked at the names, and there was a friend of mine, someone I knew, who was a dentist in Chicago, and I saw him at an event a few weeks later and told him how sorry I was to see that piece in the paper. And he said, "Oh, Jim, don't worry about it." He said, "My practice has doubled." So that's the exception to the rule.
Sure.
And although Illinois changed its criminal statutes in 1961, it was the first state to do so, and the next one wasn't until 68 or 69, mm-hmm. which was Connecticut. And it wasn't until 1973 that the American Psychiatric Association, or Psychological Association, I can't remember, very quietly removed homosexuality from the list of disorders. So, and it wasn't until the 1980s, I believe, when the New York Times first decided to use the word gay.
Instead of the term homosexual.
So that was the period in which I transitioned, if you will, from being very closeted. And by very, I mean even when I did have the occasional encounter with another gay man, I wouldn't use my name. Until a couple of years after Alice and I were divorced, when I came out to my brothers. And the experience was so liberating and such a relief that it made it easier for me, and each step became easier. My brothers, incidentally, one of them said to me, "Well, I'm really surprised. Would you please pass the potato?" And the other one, who I was not with at the time, I told him by telephone, said, "I was waiting for you to tell me." And he meant it.
So, Jim, during that same time, you were approached about the possibility of running for Congress. And at that time, you were self-identified as a moderate Republican. And you describe, at least in the book, that you had a notion that as a congressman, you might be able to do good for the country. You obviously decided not to do that for reasons probably directly related to being in transition and your concerns about
yeah.
that. But I wonder, have you ever thought about what would have happened had you chosen to take that path, and run for Congress, given what you later did, which we'll talk about in a minute, as you went through your Senate confirmation to become ambassador.
One thing, if I had run and won, one thing that would have happened is we wouldn't have had Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah. That might have been a good reason.
Aside from that, it's hard for me to imagine my life, because I certainly wouldn't have been any more willing to expose myself publicly. As a member of Congress, I would have been subject to much higher scrutiny. And I don't know whether I really would have been able to do the job that I would want to do. Mm-hmm. So in retrospect, I think it was a good decision on many fronts. Mm-hmm.
So, Jim, you did many things after you left Chicago. You went to New York and really tried to explore who you were. But shortly thereafter, you got very engaged as an activist. You traveled to the South, where you had seen things that you describe in the book having never seen before. Can you describe a little bit of what that was like, coming to understand sort of where you had grown up and what parts of the world you had yet to see and didn't know anything about, and how that inspired part of your activism?
Yes, it was a great surprise to me. I went to Washington in 1968 because of the turmoil, the political turmoil, especially after the Democratic Convention in Chicago that year. And I met a woman who, as one would say, passed for white, but who really knew her way around the South and had been very active in the movement.
An African-American woman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She offered to take me on a little tour, and I said, oh, yes, let's do it. We went to Jackson, Mississippi, and rented a car and drove to this little town in the Delta region, which, by the way, doesn't mean Mississippi Delta, it means northern Mississippi. And this little town, maybe 2,000 people, you drove in and everything looked perfectly normal, and then all of a sudden the roads were dirt, and all of a sudden the sewers were open, and all of a sudden the buildings were made of wood, spare pieces of wood and tin roofs, and you knew that you were in the section of town where the white people did not live, nor did they go. And with her help, we spent time with a number of families there. But even if I hadn't done that, I would have seen little kids with bloated bellies, the sure sign of malnutrition, in a way that I had almost never imagined in this country. I come from southern Minnesota, where the extent of diversity was whether you were Catholic or Lutheran. and we didn't have people with bloated bellies. You just didn't see them. So it was astonishing to me, and it was underscored just a couple of months later when I was in Cambodia in 1970 and saw a country where poverty reigned, and yet there was a serenity about the population there. This is before the Khmer Rouge.
Right.
There was a serenity there that I did not see in the South. Mm-hmm. Another piece, I think, that was really impressive for me was the way the people in that community dealt with their circumstance. It was almost hopeless to be a tenant farmer and to be indebted and to know that you'll spend your life paying off the debt. And yet they maintain a level of humanity that I thought was very moving and touching. Mm-hmm. And the support that they gave to each other, I think, was the core of that.
Jim, you came to San Francisco in the 70s during the controversy around the Briggs Initiative. This is an initiative that was aiming to keep gay and lesbians out of positions of educating young people.
Yes.
And shortly thereafter was really the beginning of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco. Can you talk a little bit about what the community of San Francisco was like during the activism that occurred during the Briggs Initiative and then subsequently trying to mobilize resources for HIV?
Well, when I got here, it was February of 77. And the city was experiencing the sexual revolution of the time. And all of a sudden, I mean, practically at the time I arrived, John Briggs started promoting this initiative that would prevent LGBT people from teaching in the public school system. It was a piece of legislation that he sort of borrowed from Anita Bryant Florida. And she had been successful in her campaign in Miami-Dade County. So there was great concern immediately. And all of a sudden, all of these people who had been playing their lives away became very serious and very engaged. There were leaders in California who chose to be engaged with us. The city attorney of Los Angeles, the mayor of San Francisco, and a number of other prominent politicians. Nonetheless, the initial polls, when the Briggs Initiative was qualified for the ballot, the initial polls showed that it would win by at least 60-40. So how could a group of people who were about to be disenfranchised possibly combat those statistics? That was about the time that Harvey Milk came on the scene. Harvey had run for the Board of Supervisors twice in San Francisco. And the third time around, we in the city had decided that the board would be elected by district rather than across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And this was his opportunity, which he took. So Harvey, the new member of the Board of Supervisors, suddenly became the champion against the Briggs Initiative. And he went on tour of the state debating Briggs. And the debates were very lively and often very funny, as you can imagine.
Harvey had a very good sense of humor.
Yes,
so.
He did. And that mobilized the constituency. And we found ourselves at the 60 end of the 60-40 when the votes were actually counted. So people were inspired and moved, and there was the beginning, the essence of the LGBT political constituency in California. It didn't last long because Harvey was assassinated along with George Moscone in November. This was a terrible year. This was the same year. In fact, within 2 weeks of the Jonestown massacre. And the whole city was totally depressed about what we had gone through. Harvey's assassination, I think, further mobilized the community. Yeah. And we began to realize that also our freedom was something that we had to command. It was not going to be handed to us.
So fast forward now, we're in late 70s, early 80s. We've just begun to see this devastating disease. And you were a co-founder of the Human Rights Campaign, HRC. Tell us a little bit about what inspired that, what its original mission was, you know, what the vision was for HRC when you got it off the ground.
Well, the vision was to create an institution in Washington that would be recognized. We had the Gay Rights National Lobby, which had a bank account of $40. and we weren't getting much attention. Steve Endine from Minnesota. Incidentally, a lot of people were from Minnesota. Steve, Larry Bai, who was a political scientist. Jim Foster, not from Minnesota. And David Goodstein put together a project with stated goals. And the Human Rights Campaign Fund, as it was initially called, was created to make political contributions to federal candidates for office who were publicly supportive of LGBT rights. And it was amazing. In spite of the obstacles, we raised a lot of money, about $650,000. Yeah. And this was among people who were afraid to write checks. They were afraid to write checks because their bankers would know they're gay, or their accountants. One person said that to David Goodstein, and David said, "Well, who do you think told me to ask you?"
We'll get a check from him too.
So with that money, we made contributions to a relatively small number of candidates, but our victory ratio was about 90%, and that was when people started returning Steve Endine's phone calls. So we were on our way, and what HRC has grown into with its lobbying work and its other work is consequent to that.
Absolutely.
We had our first fundraising dinner in New York in 1982, and at the very last minute, after months of cajoling, we finally got Walter Mondale to agree to speak. So it was a big deal. And I want to go back for a moment, because about the time that this was happening, HIV had appeared on the scene. And between 1980, 81, and 85 or 6, thousands of young gay men had died. And many of them were the future leaders, the future political leaders. One of them was a 21-year-old advance man for Jimmy Carter. He died when he was in his late 20s, but at that age, he was at that point in his career. One of them was the chief of staff for Phil Burton, who was within one vote of becoming the Senate Majority Leader, I mean the House Majority Leader. So we lost a lot of people, and among them, a lot of leaders.
So, Jim, later when President Clinton got elected as president, you were very supportive of him and his election. And when did the idea of you pursuing some sort of Senate-appointed position in the Clinton administration come about, and how did you think about that as it related, again, to your political activism at that time?
Well, it didn't come up in my mind. It was introduced to me.
It was introduced to me.
By a person who at that time was Clinton's treasurer for the campaign, and the campaign was still on, but he said, "You know, Jim, we're going to win this. And when we do, there will be a number of administrative appointments available, and you might consider one. To which I laughed and we joked. But he finally said, seriously, you should take a look at, I can't remember the technical name for it, but it was at that point referred to as the Plum Book. And it was a list of about 3,000 administrative positions that were available by appointment. And so I did. The Plum Book was hard to get hold of. Today it's probably online. But,
it probably is.
But back then, I got a copy from Nancy Pelosi and looked and thought, and my decision was, well, if I'm going to do this, I really wanted to do it in a way that would oblige the United States Senate to confirm the appointment. So there were a lot of administrative commissions that were interesting and a couple that people would just die to be on, but they weren't for me. And the only area that I saw in which I felt really qualified was in diplomatic relations. So I looked at the list of ambassadors. Incidentally, probably 60% of our ambassadors are career officers and 40% are political appointees. So it's not quite so big a number as people expect. Mm-hmm. And decided that's what I would go for. And what would I have to lose? So that's how it came about.
It was a little bit more than what did you have to lose. It was also about making the Senate have to take somebody who was qualified to serve and really take on the issue of confirming an openly gay, qualified individual to be ambassador.
Yes. Well, I didn't realize that I had my temper to lose.
So I want to get into that further, but before I do that, I want to tell the audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, generously sponsored by Ernst & Young, and we're talking this evening with James Hormel, the first openly LGBT person to serve as a U.S. ambassador. I'm Dr. Sandra Hernandez. I'm president of the California Healthcare Foundation and serving as the moderator tonight. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. So, Jim, who did you meet with to understand what the process would be of collecting the necessary votes for Senate confirmation, and what did you expect and what didn't you expect out of that confirmation process?
Well, initially, I had to persuade the White House that they really wanted to make an appointment. So I became very friendly with the personnel directors, and there were three of them, seriatim, over the 4 years that I was involved in that part of the process. The first one was someone I had known before. He would sort of keep me posted. As appointments were made, he would let me know, well, we've done this, but you're still on the list. And then in early 94, I was told that I was being considered to be nominated as the ambassador to Fiji. This was leaked to the Washington Post, I think, to see whether there would be any reaction to it. And there
certainly was.
There was no reaction in this country, but there was a big reaction in Fiji, where there is a very strong Methodist missionary element of some of the founders of modern Fiji, where they still had the old British colonial sodomy statute. And yes, there is enough of a fuss so that the White House dallied. And this is 1974. In the fall, the elections were not favorable. And all of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
Congress flipped, and a lot of things were put on hold. Just as a side note, the chargé d'affaires at the embassy there went to the president of Fiji, who said, this person is a political activist. And our chargé said, well, yes, he's an activist the way Elizabeth Taylor is an activist. So the president said, well, send us Elizabeth Taylor.
And so?
And so Fiji was...
Fiji didn't happen.
No, Fiji didn't happen. And I'm very happy in retrospect. I was offered several opportunities to do other things, but I wanted to stay in the realm of foreign policy and foreign relations, and managed to get myself appointed as a delegate to the Human Rights Commission in Geneva in 1995, and subsequently to the as an alternate to the delegation at the UN General Assembly in 96. These were landmark years. They were both in the United Nations, it was the 51st General Assembly, and the same at the Commission. Madeleine Albright was the ambassador to the UN at the time, and I got to work with her up through the point where she was appointed Secretary of State. So that was a great exposure, and I think helped to lead to my nomination.
And the nomination process itself was arduous, to say the least. It was inflammatory. There was a very organized movement by the extreme Christian right. And again, you've, throughout your life, been in organizations doing activism. What was your observation about how organized the opposition was to your appointment? And did it surprise you in any way?
Well, I realized how naive I had been, because it did take me completely by surprise. The State Department is a wonderful place. Once you become in their realm, they do everything they can to take care of you. And I was assigned to a truly wonderful person who guided me through the process. The first part of the process was preparing for the confirmation hearing. And what ultimately happened was that I was asked a very softball question, and that was about it. The next Tuesday, the committee met and voted, and the vote on my nomination was 16 in favor to 2 opposed. Now, Senator Helms was chair of the committee, and he did not vote for me, but he let the vote happen, which was a major step forward. And at that point, I thought, this may actually happen. I was nominated along with 8 other people, and those names all went to the Senate at the same time. Meanwhile, I was in an ambassador tutorial class with all of my fellow nominees, and I was called aside and told there's been a problem. Well, the problem was that Senator Jim Inhofe had decided that he wanted to put a hold on the nomination. Now, this is something that any single member of the Senate can do, and at that time could do anonymously, in fact. But he didn't. It was clear that it came from him. And there didn't have to be a reason given, and there was no reason given. And subsequently, he was joined by 2 other senators. That was an enormous jolt, because I wasn't really figuring on where I would go from there. The task then became how to break the hold or otherwise get the nomination to the floor of the Senate.
To get a vote. Mm-hmm.
So we worked on that, and I went to meet with Tim Hutchinson, who held Jim Inhofe's proxy And I got there prepared for everything except the questions he asked.
Which were?
There was not one single question about my competence or my knowledge of Luxembourg or my foreign relations experience or anything like that.
The Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence was on top of his mind.
The very first question was, will you disavow the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence? And I really shook my head over that. I said, well, you know, I'd never avowed them. But I said, you know, they are a 501c3 organization and they raise a lot of money for HIV and AIDS, and I'm very proud of that. And then there were other questions along that same line that were designed to be provocative. And I muddled through them, but I was not prepared for them, frankly. And he sat there with a little note of paper on his lap, and occasionally he'd look at it, but I never got to see it. So the next day, Senator Hutchinson said that he thought that it would be wrong for the United States to send an openly gay individual to a country that was 95% Roman Catholic, and that he was opposed, and that he didn't think that I would be suitable. Now, of course, that disregards the fact that before a person is nominated to be ambassador, the government always goes to the government of the country involved and asks for something that is officially called agrément, which means agreement. And so Luxembourg had already given its agreement to this appointment, to this nomination. Senator Hutchinson was oblivious.
He knew better than the people of Luxembourg.
Yes. So the questions he asked were so outrageous. I hate even to go into them, especially noting that he had gone to Bob Jones University, and the things that Bob Jones has said about the Catholic Church and the Pope are outrageous.
So when you got to Luxembourg, Jim, did you get involved with the gay community there? Obviously you were representing us in that country and you had many diplomatic responsibilities.
Yeah.
Did you have an opportunity while you were there to get engaged?
Well, I did. And the community was very easy to find. It was not in any way underground. I met people there who were supportive and who identified themselves to me as being gay. During the time I was there, Luxembourg had an LGBT film festival. They had, on my arrival, just elected a young gay man to the parliament, to the national parliament, and they were considering domestic partnership legislation. This is 1999, and I'm delighted to say that last year, in 2013's elections, national elections, the country chose an openly gay prime minister and an openly gay deputy prime minister. So the people who were accusing me of going there with an agenda, you know, they were right.
Yeah, you got them all elected. So, Jim, I want to spend a little bit of time delving a little bit into your philanthropy. And in fact, when you were going through the confirmation process, the protagonists that were intent on stopping your confirmation raised a lot of issues about a very important gift that you made to this city and to the public in general, which was to the gift that you made to the library in San Francisco, and in particular to the gay and lesbian collection that's there. I wonder if you talk a little bit about how you thought about that as a gift, why it was important for you to do that, notwithstanding the fact that they then later tried to use it against you. But what was your political and philanthropic aspirations for that library?
Well, I guess I saw it as an opportunity that would never come along again. Here was a brand new building, and they were trying to create affinity groups, African-American, Latino, LGBT. They were also stuck in their fundraising because although the building had been financed by a bond issue, I believe, the furnishing and support of the building was not.
Can't be paid for with a bond.
And so we were about halfway through a campaign of $110 million, I believe it was. And all of a sudden, money stopped coming in.
You were on the commission at that time?
No, I wasn't. I was just an interested party.
Okay.
But the head of the library commission was a gay man. And he held a meeting at his home with a group of community people whom he knew and discussed the possibility of putting together a center at the library. And the more he talked about it, the more enthusiastic I got. So the next day I started contemplating what that would entail. And ultimately, I wanted to make sure that whatever we created would exist in perpetuity, that some future administration wouldn't come along and say, well, we don't need to do this anymore. So a contract was drawn that included provisions. And the money which I contributed was divided, I think, 4/5 for the center and 1/5 for an endowment. And it did seem to make a difference to the library drive. But what really surprised me the most was we had one fundraising dinner. I was out of town and came back the afternoon of the dinner. It was being held at the Hyatt Regency. And I had no idea, how it had been going because I'd been away for about a week and a half. When I arrived at the Hyatt Regency, I saw this room from the porte cochere that had about 300 seats in it. And I thought, oh my God, this is not good. I went into the atrium where they were having a cocktail reception, and it looked a lot better there. And then I realized, or I was told, that the room that I had seen was the spillover room. Those were people that couldn't be accommodated in the ballroom. And so with that one event, we raised more than our goal. I mean, more than the goal for the entire center. And it came from, I shouldn't say just from that event, but the support for the center came from about 3,000 people from around the country. It was very touching.
Jim, I want to ask you the question, many of us who, grew up, whether there were sodomy laws or, sort of the Defense of Marriage Act. Today there are, 27, 29 states that sort of one after another have struck down as unconstitutional bans on gay marriage. In 2008, you were here when Phyllis and Del got married.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond sort of the emotional aspect of that, is there something that you would anticipate that is behind us completing that work in this country from the point of view of the LGBT movement? Would you name anything else that is important? What's the unfinished business?
There's a lot of it. And I want to acknowledge, first of all, where we are today, because it's quite remarkable that we have gotten to this point in my lifetime. But what we do not yet have is a protection from job discrimination and housing discrimination. We have it individually in 21 states. But there are 29 states that have yet to act, and the federal government has come close a couple of times in the Senate. Believe it or not, in 1996, they were within one vote of passing a bill. But that bill didn't include transgender. And currently, there is a bill that is languishing and will, I will wager, languish until at least 2017. The marriage situation is a little different, but the states, many of the states where the marriage ban has been struck down, are still subject to appeal. So we have work to do there. We have work to do in veterans' rights. We have work to do in immigration. We have all kinds of areas of our society that need protection. So when we get through all of that, and I would love to see it happen in my lifetime, we will still be confronting the social aspects of acceptance. And how long that will take, I don't know. There's a message that I have, and it's a message I've used for 25 years at least, which is come out. And by come out, I mean every day, you and I and others who are already out to their friends and families have the opportunity to come out to strangers, to people they work with, to people they travel with. And the more we are known, I think the more we will be respected and accepted. So that's what I see as the goal. And this goal is really challenging because as I look at other minorities, you know, it's still in process. It's still in process. One tangible example is the Equal Rights Amendment, which was written in 1920 and has yet to be ratified.
There's a lot of political work yet to do, Jim. Do you, in this appeals process that you mentioned, do you see a scenario where LGBT issues might end up in front of the Supreme Court? And if so, do you have any thoughts about our current composition of the Supreme Court and how our issues might fare there?
I'm very optimistic. And that may not be realism, but I feel very optimistic. When this process began, states were ratifying bans on marriage equality right and left. And then all of a sudden the process reversed. But the process reversed mainly through the courts. And the process is still very much in the courts. But the courts at this point, I think, are deciding unanimously in favor of marriage equality. And by the time this gets back to the Supreme Court, which it will probably within a year or two, those nine justices are going to be looking at appellate judges across the country who have unanimously, at least up until now, supported marriage equality. And what are they going to do with that? You know, they already have a case, Lawrence versus Texas, which they decided 6-3 in 2003. And the dissenting opinion of Justice Scalia in that case says almost as much as I have just said. You know, based on the facts and the conclusions in this case, it's very hard to imagine that we can't support marriage equality. So I take him at his word.
So you're optimistic. I'm taking a few questions now from the audience, Jim. And this really has to do with your time in the State Department. And you mentioned that there's protocols and the like. In your view, is the State Department any more open now than, you know, from the time you were the ambassador?
Well, so far as I know, the short answer is yes. When I became ambassador, there were virtually no provisions whatever for partners, domestic partners.
By the time, provisions meaning?
Meaning in terms of any sort of accommodation and travel arrangements or anything. There was nothing. For spouses, yes. For domestic partners, no. When I left almost 2 years later, Madeleine Albright had a reception the night before the government turned over, mm-hmm. and I attended, and she was very excited to come to me and let me know that she had just finished signing 13 different documents that provided change in the administrative policy toward domestic partnerships and toward ambassadorial regulations. And so I do know that that happened. Wow. Then a couple of years later, Michael Guest was appointed as ambassador to Romania. And although it didn't come up at his confirmation hearings, when he was sworn in, Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State at the time, introduced his partner to the audience at the swearing-in. And the next day, the people who were crazy about my being appointed went crazy over him, but he was already on his way. And since then, I think there have been, since Michael, there have been five other openly gay ambassadorial appointments that have been approved. And in the course of that, since Hillary Clinton has been Secretary of State, there are new provisions for domestic partners and spouses that are, that you know, level the playing field.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, generously sponsored by Ernst & Young, and we're talking this evening with James Hormel, the first openly LGBT person to serve as a U.S. ambassador. I'm Sandra Hernandez, president of the California Healthcare Foundation, your moderator for tonight's program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Jim, the next question from the audience is really about countries that continue to have sodomy laws, large countries, many of whom the U.S. is in diplomatic relations in and have very complex relationships with. Having been in the diplomatic corps and really been in and around these issues for many years, what do you foresee as the future of the United States as it relates to our foreign affair policies with countries that are openly and blatantly homophobic?
Well, I think that the countries really fall into a couple of categories. One being those non-sectarian states, which simply have offensive regulations or laws, and the other being states that have a religious foundation throughout their government and have rules that come out of that religious affiliation. The latter group is, I think, much more challenging. because there is such a strong belief system around the laws, and not just laws about homosexuality, but other laws, dietary laws, and lots of laws. The non-sectarian countries, I don't know what to say about. I look at Russia, and I can't help seeing the Soviet Union. I mean, it's just amazing how that country has moved in that direction in the past couple of years. And very disheartening and frightening, frankly. But I think that is a cyclical thing, and I do believe that that there will be a movement away. Nonetheless, I feel those countries who support equality and freedom need to press Russia and other countries on their policies. There are extremes in Africa. Uganda is one of them. And it's interesting that people like Senator Inhofe have made quite a few trips to Uganda in the past decade or so, and have helped to promote their current laws, which are terribly harsh. So I really don't have a direct answer for how to support those people other than to have them know that we do support them, and to provide immigration laws that are accommodating, and to encourage people who do get here to seek asylum and to seek other protections that will keep them from going back into an uncertain fate. Mm-hmm. It's very distressing to me.
Jim, someone in the audience asks, there are still places in our society, in this country, where coming out is absolutely an act of courage, notably in professional sports. Mm-hmm. Michael Sam recently came out, professional, drafted into the NFL, got a lot of media attention as someone who was able to, as you would say, come out to his teammates, but also to NFL and to football. This is a very male-dominated, very macho mm-hmm. culture. Others have done it in the NBA. When those people come out in those places where societally this is still quite homophobic, how do you think about that in terms of moving us societally to being a more inclusive community?
People just have to live through it. I'm afraid I lived through Jackie Robinson, and it was very impressive to see how he managed to deal with people spitting on him and throwing things at him and locking him away from his teammates and all of the really, really nasty things that people could think of to do. I hope this doesn't happen to Michael Sam or Jason Collins or some of the others. There will be others soon, I have no doubt. And time will temper those things. There is a great deal of courage behind Michael Sam, for example, and there's courage behind the St. Louis Rams, and I pray for his success there. But we will see others following. And there are other professions that are less obvious than that one. The entertainment world, especially in music, mm-hmm. Where there are a lot of gay people who are unwilling to be exposed as gays and lesbians. There is an underground constituency in Washington, D.C., which is composed of administrative staff people. Many of them today, of course, are Republicans, who will absolutely not reveal their sexuality to their employer. They're terrified of doing that. And that's got to end. But that will take a different kind of courage. That will just take a willingness to stand up and tell their boss that he's wrong. Mostly he, sometimes she.
I don't know, it all seems like a lot of courage to me in all the things we've been talking about tonight, Jim. I wonder, you've been a very generous philanthropist, and I wonder, in addition to, we talked a little bit about your gift and really leading a community to support the library here, are there any other gifts that for you have been particularly meaningful as a philanthropist? I know you get asked to give to many, many causes and to many, many movements and to certainly the democracy and civic life of our country. And those are all different buckets, but I wonder, Jim, are there any others that we didn't mention tonight that you would that would be top of your mind as being particularly important to you?
I've made significant gifts to my educational institutions, Swarthmore and the University of Chicago, directed primarily toward social justice. I've made gifts to other organizations that are dedicated to social justice, which I feel are doing an amazing job in promoting the well-being of the general public. So those are the areas where I feel I've been able to make a bit of a difference. I do not have the means that some people do, and some of those people are using their means very well. We see it here in San Francisco, and we're very blessed. But I would encourage people who are not philanthropic to examine their own lives and how they got to where they are and how they might make things better in their lives and around them, and pursue their drive to have a nicer world. We've done so much damage to our planet. But this is everyone's home. We all have to live in it and die in it. So let's make the best of it.
Jim, as you mentioned earlier that you know, some of our political gains have benefited parts of our community. And I just wonder, do you have any closing thoughts about, in particular, the transgender community, which even amongst the LGBT community have very unique issues? Do you have any final thoughts for us about that part of our movement?
I'm very glad you brought it up, because I would feel bad if we left here without discussing issues that affect the transgender community. I was in Geneva in, I think, 2006 for a conference where I met the very first elected transgender official from Japan. And I thought to myself, wow, they're way ahead of us. and I was, as a tennis player living on Kauai at the time, I was calling lines at an Avon tournament, which was the second tournament played by Renee Richards. So I got to see her and know her and convince myself that she had done the right thing. So, you know, I realized from my own personal experience that we need to be exposed just as we need to be exposed to every other element of our society. We need to know about transgender people, and we need to know about it from them. So I encourage that.
Well, that would probably be a good place to stop. Let me thank you for really a lifetime of extraordinary work. I started with a quote from your book where you couldn't imagine yourself being a civic leader, and you sit here today amongst colleagues and friends who consider you a mentor, and really somebody who's broken through at your own peril and at, I'm sure, your own pain, many, many glass ceilings on behalf of many, many of us in the movement. So thank you, Ambassador Hormel.
Well, thank you, and I'd like to add one thing, because we haven't addressed the Q either.
No, we haven't.
And the Q is very important. I was a Q for very briefly. If I had been honest with myself, I wouldn't have been a Q at all. But people who are questioning their sexuality need guidance, and they need honest and direct and open guidance. So I think we can all look for ways of providing that and providing support. The parent who says, "I love you no matter what," is saying, "I release you." You know, it's great. It's really great. And I brought with me, I won't try to find it, a headline from a boy who lives in California. And the headline says, "California teenager worries that there will be nothing left for him to be the first gay person."
On that note, we should end. Our thanks to James Hormel. Our thanks to James Hormel, advocate, philanthropist, and the first openly LGBT person to serve as a U.S. ambassador, and to Ernst & Young for sponsoring this program and the entire Commonwealth Club series on the LGBTQ journey this August. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio and the internet. I'm Dr. Sandra Hernandez, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.